Okay, so today I'd like to present a work done in collaboration with Mark Timmer and Fred Wolf. We are at the Max Planck Institute für Strömungsforschung in Göttingen. I say this in German because the name doesn't make much sense. And the University of Göttingen. And it'll be about speed limits and unstable attractors in synchronizing networks. Now, this time, this talk has been announced just fine in the program, so I can't make this joke like last December when I got Max Planck assigned as a co-author, or 15 years ago at this institute when I got J.W. Goethe as a co-author. So J.W. Goethe meets Dr. Seuss. So back to my subject. This now is not Max Planck, nor Goethe, but Mark Timmer, who was a graduate student, now a postdoc, and Fred Wolf sitting here. Okay, when you heard about Hopfield's and others' idea of associative memory, whereby a system runs into an attractor, a system has attractors and basins of attraction that are reached asymptotically, and a task is performed by the attraction into the attractor. Then you might have wondered, how does the system ever get out back again from this attractor, or how does my brain get out from such an attractor again? And you probably need a lot of external noise or a very strong signal to get out of this. And here's another possibility, at least hypothesis, that consists in unstable attractors, so objects that have a basin of attraction which lead into the attractor, but which have some instability attached to them. And this can give the system a much higher degree of flexibility and help it getting out of an attractor easily, which is important when successive tasks have to be performed. So you listen to speech, listen to me, and you have to recognize my words one after the other, and so you should not get stuck in one of these attractors or words. Now, another issue is synchronization, and on the negative side, there is well known that epileptic seizures are related to synchronized activity, and then you'd ask, how do I get out of the, how could I break this synchronization? Or how does it occur in such a seizure? And also, synchronization has been speculated to play functional roles, and therefore, imagine that an animal has to react fast in a certain situation, escape a predator or catch a prey. And if this is related to synchronization, then it's important what is the speed of synchronization. And so how fast does the system react to produce some synchronized activity? And then we'd like to know what is the speed of synchronization, and can we get any rigorous result? How does the speed of synchronization depend on the type of network, the topology of the network, etc.? So talking about random networks. And so those are questions that I'll address today. And of course, questions like this, you cannot answer them in, say, very complicated models that you simulate numerically. You better start out with a somewhat abstract model, idealized model that you can treat analytically and get perhaps partly, we'll get partly rigorous results. and partly we need simulations. And so I will come to this. And in order to motivate this simple model, let me give you some introduction to the so-called binding problem, where it was speculated that synchronization could play a role. So this is a a picture by the camouflage artist Beth Doolittle. And what your retina sees are white and brown patches. Okay. But your brain, of course, sees more, because it binds these patches on your retina. It binds them together into an entity, some object that you recognize, that your brain recognizes as a horse. So these collection of patches form what is called a gestalt in cognitive psychology. And the brain uses some clues for this binding, to bind all these extended patches into one object. And that tells you it is one object, it is a horse. So this is what's called binding. And the artist, Beverly Doolittle, has done her maximum to make this binding as complicated as possible for us. So the brain, in order to recognize this horse as an object, as an entity, the brain uses clues such as shape, that is continuity. Well, look here, for instance. Continuity is broken. You expect, say, a belly of the horse. That would be, if it were brown all the way, there would be continuity, but it's broken here. It uses color, movement, and so on as clues to bind these objects together. Okay, here's another example for the binding problem. When you look at the right, perhaps some of you will detect something, recognize something in this figure. No? Well, okay, some people have seen it before. So there is a square hidden in it, right? Here. And you don't see this because you don't see it immediately. Because this continuity is broken. If it were entirely continuous, then you would see it, of course. And so it takes a while to detect it, since this continuity is not entirely fulfilled. Another example on the left. Do you see anything there? No. So there is also a square. And it has even less continuity, so collinearity. But if I give you another clue, like motion, I can't, right? Oh, there's some problem with the dual head thing here. Still not. Oh. You need to go out of this for a minute. Sorry. How do I get out of this? Better? No, I need to go out. Since I'm... Oh, here I am, yeah. I need to get out of my picture here to get into this one. That's the point. Okay. Always forget. Come on. Okay, so I give you another clue from motion. Oh, it's slow. Okay, now you see the square, right? So the brain uses such clues as such features as motion, continuity, shape, and so on, to bind such an object. And now these features are processed in different areas. Well, let me give you the last one first. So, oops. Here's another example. Black and white patches. So I put this in black and white. And most people don't see anything. Some people see something. And perhaps this looks like a birch forest to you, perhaps. But there is more to it. And if I give you color as a clue, then you see a fox. And well, I won't help you. So suggestions.
I find it more difficult with color than without.
Oh, okay. Okay. Here, here's a horse. Right. Here's its head. A fox. Another horse. Where is it? Here. Okay. And there are two Indians sitting on these horses. Okay. So that's. I think apparently, since you recognize it better in black and white and I better in color, apparently I don't know. Okay, so there are various clues. Like maybe this was not conclusive to you, but there are various clues that the brain uses: various features, color, motion, shape. And others that are processed in different and distant areas of the brain. So there is another binding problem, say, second version of it. The first was, how does the brain bind an extended object into one entity, or an extended set of pixels? And now here we bind together various features, like shape and motion, into one entity to recognize this entity. And so those features are processed in different areas. And then you can ask, how does the brain manage to bind these neurons into one entity that are in different areas? Okay, an example or a suggestion that was made a long time ago that was that this feature binding could be managed by synchrony. So here in this example of this image, with a woman and a cat, it would mean that the neurons that represent the pixels and the neurons that represent the woman would fire in synchrony, and thereby encoding the fact that this is one entity. And the neurons shown here, the blue ones, that represent the cat, would also fire in synchrony with respect to each other, but not in synchrony with respect to the woman. And so in this way, one could encode different entities. Or even if you had, for instance, a brown cat and a black cat in the same picture, then you would, these different cats would have neurons that fire, that do not fire in synchrony between the two cats. Now again, how do those neurons, if this is true, let me come to this afterwards and mention the experimental results. his hypothesis became was reactivated when Gray and Singer and others and Ekorn independently discovered 40 hertz synchronization in so-called 40 hertz oscillations in the cortex. And there are various experiments. I've picked out one that is remarkable because it's in the two hemispheres of the visual cortex. And so the connections between these neurons go through the corpus callosum. And so there's a big distance between the neurons in left and right hemisphere. And nevertheless, you see that there is some synchronization. The yellow bars correspond to 40 hertz. So there is a tendency of firing in synchrony for these neurons that are far apart. And so this gave support for this hypothesis, binding via synchronization, and triggered a lot of activities, theoretical activities also.
I'd like to go one step further. So can you say under what circumstances does it depend on what the external stimulus is, whether
yes.
you have synchronization or not?
Yeah. Yes, they imagined that they did many experiments on this. And I think the first or the simplest was to take a moving bar. Actually, I should have said this is with a moving bar. And then they had a single bar or two pieces of the bar moving in synchrony or moving against each other. And so the strength of the synchronization, that is the correlation function, depended on whether it was a continuous object or whether it was broken. But there are many more experiments on this. So I just wanted to give you this as a motivation why we look into synchronization of neurons, and also why the question is important: how does such a network synchronize over long distances? And shortly before I go on, I would like to mention some other examples of synchronizing networks. It's important for power grids, power plants, and you see, should recognize this continent. And this was not long ago when this is not a new Hudson Bay or so. Hudson Bay is up here. I guess this was a blackout in New York and surroundings. And this is how it looked from the bottom. And this blackout is, of course, also related to synchronization among power plants. And another example where synchronization is important in everyday life is pedestrians on bridges, which has been understood recently in the year 2000. A bridge, it's a kind of network like this here, simple network. The bridge has a mass, and here are the pedestrians, which have a mass, and they interact with each other. And now here's an example. Oh, again, I have to go out of this thing.
The bridge opened on the 10th of June 2000, attracting thousands of people and the media. But as the people pulled over the bridge, it was clear something was wrong. The bridge was wobbling from side to side.
So the bridge forced the people to move in synchrony.
Oh, but it's a little bit. There's an exaggeration going on. But Roger said, no, this is real. And so I came down in the afternoon, and you saw it, and you think, this isn't real, this can't be happening. It was very disappointing. Witnessing the bridge performing in a way that we hadn't anticipated. We'd done lots of work to try and understand its behavior. We felt that we understood it very well, and here it is doing something completely unexpected.
Okay, unexpected was the fact that there could be some synchronization in such a network where you would have to include the pedestrians also, these thousands of pedestrians in the on the Millennium Bridge. Okay, Nick, another example, yeah.
Are you saying that something about the way the bridge is moving was causing the pedestrians to start to walk in the sand in lockstep?
Yeah, you could see it in one point when I showed it to you. You want to see it again? Maybe afterwards. In one moment you could see that the pedestrians, can you see, walk like this here, right? In synchrony. And it's because the bridge was already moving laterally. And so the pedestrians, in order to balance or to counterbalance, also moved against this in synchrony. And this, of course, was a feedback to the bridge, and feedback loop, if you want. I'll show it to you afterwards, if you want. Here's another example. No, not yet. Actually, the original example that was given by Mirolo and Storgatz, they had in mind synchronization of fireflies that live on certain trees, and they just send out their light pulses synchronously. And now we're interested in the neurons. And now I'd like to introduce shortly this, or in a few steps, this model, this idealized model to study synchronization dynamics. So we assume, well, the model actually goes back to Mirolo and Storgatz, and I come to this. We assume just a phase going around a circle, so with constant velocity. And when the phase or some function of it reaches a threshold, say arrives here, then this unit sends out a pulse, delta pulse, a spike, that is received by other neurons or units. And these neurons are influenced, set forward in their phase or so. And they also fire and send out spikes, pulses, and so on. So that's the idea, a phase oscillator that goes just around a circle if it's not influenced by anything else. More exactly, well, I have still not defined the model. as I said, this type of network was first introduced and studied by Mirolo and Storgatz. They only considered excitatory coupling, and they showed that the complete synchrony is an attractor, and it's the only attractor. So all units fire in synchrony in this case of global coupling and excitatory coupling. Hey. Now, what we have done almost 10 years ago is to generalize this model to include also the presence of delays. Since in every realistic network, realistic natural system, it takes some time to transport a pulse or a spike along an axon or whatever. So. We need to consider the influence of delays, and this is what we did. And also, that was in 1995, we studied the case of inhibitory coupling. And what we saw was that the presence of delays, changes drastically the stability properties. And we have instead of having one unique attractor, we have exponentially many attractors, and also we have unstable attractors. So these are things that we understood much more recently, and things that I'm going to explain. Now, finally, we consider a more complex network structure that is not globally coupled units. Then we can ask, how does the topology of the network influence synchronization? And we have determined speed limits due to topology, speed limits for the synchronization speed. Okay, now here's the model, first in the case of two neurons, one and two units. As I said, without any coupling, the phase increases linearly in time, and as a function of this phase, you have a membrane potential or some function U1 of phi that is defined as a concave down function, monotonously increasing. And when this function, call it membrane potential, reaches a threshold, a spike is sent, like here, and the function is set back to zero and starts to increase again. So those are the ingredients of the model. Now when a second or another neuron receives such a spike, as you can see here, it spiked itself at this time. Now the first neuron sends out a spike, a pulse, at time zero, and now in our model, our extension, it takes the time tau to reach the second neuron. And after this time tau, the spike is received, and the second neuron integrates this delta pulse, and so it performs a step upwards in its membrane potential, and then it continues increasing as before. Okay, so that's the idea. Of course, since it's set forward, it will reach the threshold earlier than it would have, and so it sends out a spike earlier than it would have done if it had been independent. The what?
The curve after the reception of
it. It's defined by two things. Okay. It's the phase velocity, which is constant, equal one.
Okay.
And this function U of phi. I come to this in the next transparency. I come to this in the next transparency. You'll see. So let me just give this. The threshold is at one. We have a delay time tau, and we have a coupling strength epsilon that is just the height of this jump, or the factor in front of the delta function. So here's the answer to your question. The model is defined by some function, some concave down function U of phi, okay, like this. This is given. And then we have an additional condition, which is phi dot equal constant. So phi moves constant speed from left to right. Okay, so that's it. And now the other ingredients are the spiking and reset when the threshold is crossed, and when the spike is received by some other neuron, that neuron is set forward. It gets a kick of height epsilon. And this can be seen differently by knowing just the function U of phi, which we define in the beginning, which we assume in the beginning. This can be described differently in this way, very simply by this function. So if that neuron is at phi 1, it has a mainframe potential U of phi 1 here, okay, it gets an additional kick, epsilon. And so this is as if it had been set forward to a bigger phase, phi, which is just U to the minus 1 of this here, right?
So
the spikes received when closer
to threshold will have a larger effect, would be more effective.
Yeah, there is a difference.
Why that? Is it critical?
You could it is. This is okay. This is the contents of this talk, of this first part at least. Okay, so this is essentially the model, and it contains other models, a number of other models. Let me just mention this one, which is the leaky integrand fire neuron, which you describe, this is just too high for me, which you describe by such a differential equation, at least when it's not firing, and you could also have some nonlinear function of V here, or variations of this model, and still be able to describe this by such a model with some monotonous function U of phi. Now here this gives rise to an increasing membrane potential as we know, and okay, maybe I should not go into details of this, but you get some function U, V of t, and if you rescale this properly by rescaling the time in this way with a scalar phi and transforming the V in this way into U, then you get such a function U of phi, which is just describing this monotonous increase of the membrane potential. Yeah.
So the change epsilon then depends on
No, this is what? Oh well, you can assume various models in the cases that we consider. Say in the first part of this talk, we assume it as constant, and in the second part, it's slightly different. But also, what we do is we assume negative epsilons, which means inhibitory coupling. And so then the phase is set back to some previous phase. Okay. And so those are the ingredients that we added to the model. And of course, the time delays are very important as an ingredient. So it's what we added to the Mirolo and Strogatz model. Inhibition and delays. Now, here are some numerical results. Maybe, no, I should first explain the case of two neurons, and I don't know where to do it. Is this fine here? Okay. In the case of two neurons, this can be treated analytically, and it's an old work published in 1995. You could derive a return map of the phase difference when one neuron fires, the phase difference to the other one, delta phi, and the next phase difference, delta phi prime. And so one can determine a return map analytically. In the case of delays, and the return map actually looks like this for inhibitory coupling. Let me first mention the excitatory coupling. So, Okay. And so this depends, this shape depends on the type of u or phi that you assume the function. And there is one way to assume such a function that makes this piecewise linear and even easier to study, but it can be any function, any monotonous concave down function. And then the shape depends on this function. But what you see here is that in this return map for excitatory coupling, the alpha phi equals zero fixed point becomes unstable. And this is this tau here. And another fixed point at some phase lag tau becomes stable. And again, here's another unstable fixed point, and this one is the same. So and this can be done analytically, and so one sees that synchronization between two neurons becomes unstable at phase lag zero if there is a finite, small but finite delay time. And on the other hand, let me put it here, in the case of inhibitory coupling, this map looked like this. Oops, sorry. Okay, so there are linear pieces, infinite slope, and then again, this function depends on this piece depends on the type of function that you assume for u of phi, and for inhibitory coupling, the phase lag zero becomes stable. This is a stable fixed point. And here you have unstable fixed points. And here is again a stable point. So this showed us that there is a tendency of neurons to synchronize when they are coupled inhibitorily, and of neurons to desynchronize when they are coupled excitatorily, when there are time delays present. Beg your pardon?
If the coupling actually fails to work, right?
Oh, well. Didn't study this. I mean, this was just it's something that you can study analytically. Just derive this return map by making quite a number of case distinctions. So it's a little complicated, but it can be done. Now here's these are old results which we already had in 1995. I have it somewhere. No, somewhere here. No. Oof. I have the reference. Yes. Here's the original paper by Murillo and Strogatz, and what I've been presenting now was published in this paper in 1995 with Udo Ernst and Klaus Pawelczyk. And at this time we already saw some peculiar phenomenon in the numerical study of large networks, which could not be treated analytically. And we understood what was going on much more recently. Now, again, what you see here on top, or let me mention this here, we assume global coupling all to all, and constant coupling strength, epsilon ij, larger than zero, so it's epsilon larger zero, it's excitatory coupling. And this is just illustrating the Mirolo-Strogatz case. 100 different neurons that fire, and the time steps are given in the firing of one reference neuron. Yes? Well, this is all part of my of what I will come to. So, okay. What you see here is that these various phases of these 100 neurons converge down to phase zero or up to phase one, which is the same. So, this just illustrates when you don't have a delay and excitatory coupling, that there's one unique attractor, which is the synchronous firing of all units. And this is stable, since as you add noise to it, this doesn't change much, so there's this unique attractor that remains. But here comes, yes. Yes.
And the taus also are the same.
Yes. At least you could take variations thereof. But so here we'll focus on.
Are you going to discuss the case where the taus, the distribution of taus?
No. But I mean.
But is that realistic that the things are located in different places?
Well, you have to start with something. And there's a big bulk of work that we've been done, especially Mark Timmer. And I have to focus on a few things and just start with the simpler cases first. So, I don't have a figure, I think, for the inhibitory coupling apart here in the next one. Yeah, well, okay. Let's first look at this here. For now, we assume time delays, noise-free case first, and inhibitory coupling. This is up here. Actually, this is including noise, but without noise, it would look like this also, up to here. So here the neurons synchronize in a number of different clusters with different phases. And so they fire, depending to which cluster they belong, they fire at a particular phase. The phase goes from 0 to 1. And this is a stable attractor, apparently. This is what we see numerically. That's the inhibitory coupling. And again, looks as if the inhibitory coupling would tend to a stable attraction, stable synchronization. Whereas the excitatory coupling, in the presence of delays always, tends to instability. Okay, now excitatory coupling. Now with delays, and first in the noise-free case, what you see is some kind of attraction, again, very similar to the inhibitory coupling, an attraction into clusters with different phases. And in fact, we find exponentially many attractors in contrast to this unique attractor. In the what? Well, the number of attractors is not identical to the number of clusters. So what you see here is just the number of clusters for a particular attractor. But there are other attractors, and so the number of clusters goes like 1 over tau. What?
For the excitatory case, the number of the clusters is not tau.
Oh, yes, right. This is, here, for this case, it is like 1/12, the number of clusters. And, okay. So this is a striking difference, let me make this point, between, say, the case of note time delay, unique attractor, and exponentially many attractors. Since those are point attractors in phase space, periodic attractors, they you find an exponentially increasing number of them as the number of units increases. Okay, so that's one striking difference. Another striking difference is, as you add noise, you see that apparently there is some attraction, some convergence of different units into clusters of given phases. But then, after some time, there's also some divergence. These clusters dissolve again. And there's some switching into some other clusters, which dissolve again. Here you see it here very nicely. And so on. So there's a perpetual switching. And this is something which we observed numerically, but did not understand at this time. Here's another numerical illustration, which tells us something. Inhibitory cluster, for the inhibitory coupling, now we add just a momentary perturbation, not noise, just an instantaneous perturbation here at this arrow. And for the inhibitory coupling and the excitatory coupling, and what you see. Now note that the time scale is different here. The phase scale is different. Resolving this here, you see that the cluster splits up, and after some time it comes back exponentially to this unique attracting phase. This is what you see when you magnify this part for inhibitory coupling, and it tells us there is some stability. And for the excitatory coupling, if you do the same thing, we see that, note that this scale is again different from this scale here. 10^4, 10^3. So the cluster splits up and continues splitting up. So there is an exponential divergence of these phases in this cluster. And this indicates some unstable clustering, okay? Some instability. Although we noted some convergence here, some attraction in the beginning. Okay, first, can we understand this tendency? I actually claim that this is what you are seeing here is an unstable attractor.
Is there a question
about what the time scale for the switching has? I don't know yet. But we studied some time scale of switching and synchronization, but I'll come to this in a different context afterwards. You're claiming that this is an unstable attractor, and we'll give more reasons for this. But first of all, can we understand why there is stability for inhibitory interactions? It's actually intuitively easy to understand. Imagine you have two neurons at phase phi 1 and phi 2, which receive a spike from some third neuron. And they are coupled inhibitorily, so to this third neuron, so they are set backward in phase, like this and like that. And so the phase difference, due to the concave down function, U of phi, the phase difference here decreases. And this is a mechanism for attraction, convergence. And of course, for the excitatory coupling, it is just the opposite. Imagine you have these two phase different phases here, and the successive phases will be more distant than before. Okay, this is then what you just saw. For the inhibitory coupling, a single random perturbation demonstrates the instability, and this occurs for extremely small perturbations, so even 10 to the minus 14, and shows that it's not some small boundary that has to be overcome, but it's just instability. Now, in order to understand this phenomenon, Mark Timmer studied a small network which can be handled analytically of six neurons, six for the symmetry, and it's just what you still can do if... So for these six neurons, again, we have clusters, and in this simulation, we've added instantaneous perturbations at these moments here. And what happened was that these clusters split up and go into some new periodic state, other clusters, and again. And so you see this switching. And it's a switching between three different attractors that are marked in red, yellow, and blue. Since these are attractors, there are three point attractors in phase space. The phase space is six-dimensional, and this shows a two-dimensional section through this phase space determined by, so the plane is determined by these three attractors. They are given by red, yellow, and blue spots in phase space. So these three spots are the attractors. And now one can determine analytically the linear stability properties, stability matrix around these fixed points. And one can also determine the basins of attraction. And what you let me first show the basins of attraction. What you see here is that every fixed point is surrounded by some basin of attraction, which is colored according to the same code. So the red is surrounded by some basin of attraction, that is yellow, from some other attractor, the yellow one. There is also a gray basin of attraction in various grayscales here, which are attractors that are not in this plane and that are just permutations of these three attractors. Now, apparently what happens is that if this yellow is the basin of attraction of this distant attractor, then if you start in this basin, your system will be attracted into this attractor. And if there is some noise, some perturbation, then this perturbation will drive you out of the attractor into the basin of another attractor, which is blue here, or its permutation. And so you will be driven into the blue point attractor, and so on. The stability analysis is in terms of a five-dimensional stability matrix, gives us four eigenvalues equal zero. So there is some something like superstability where you can jump in finite time onto a lower dimensional manifold, and one eigenvalue that is larger than one. So that shows us that there is instability in this fixed point. But nevertheless, those are attractors because, well, as you could see, there was a convergence here, and there are basins of attraction. Now, this is not the what most people have in mind when they are thinking of attractors, because usually people intuitively think that attractors must always be stable. But there is a more general definition of an attractor due to Milner, the Milner attractor, or more exactly the minimal Milner attractor, which does not require that you have a contracting neighborhood of the attractor, but just you need a basin of attraction from which you're driven into the attractor. And apparently here, this is what happens here, so we can call this an unstable attractor. So apparently this is what happens here, because the basin of attraction, so the yellow area here, is apart from the attractor in yellow. Okay. No, because what is essential here is the discontinuities, which are due to the spiking. So that these discontinuities are the reason for having an attractor separated from its basin. Okay, so this is in using the terminology of Milner, we can call this a minimal Milner attractor. And it has these features that it has a basin of attraction, and nevertheless it's unstable.
Okay.
Oh, the discontinuity is in time. You see this on the time axis. In all these figures, time is discrete, and it is defined by the steps are defined by the firing of a reference oscillator. So neuron number zero fires, and this gives the rhythm for determining the phase. Hmm? Now this is to give you some intuition. Maybe I should speed up a little bit. Sure. If you have very general perturbations and say noise, permanent noise, unlike the case that I just told you, then you would come back to the same attractor. But here we even excluded the other attractors that are just permutations of those, because they would drive us into some other plane.
So you have to see a basin which is far from your attractor in space, right? So you're
yes.
In the basin, at some point you jump
mm-hmm.
to that attractor. Wherever you start in the basin, you jump to that attractor at some point. Mm-hmm.
This will be illustrated now.
Before, the gray basin, the yellow basin, to the basis of that thought. There is no dimensional management through which you reach that volume.
You jump from the volume to the dimension manifold and then you flow along with the point direction. But still you jump. So why don't you see jumps when you just follow in time?
Oh, because you see the jumps here. Okay, let me go back. This is not continuous time, as I said before. Right? You see the jumps here. This is just various instants that are determined by the firing of the first reference oscillator. This is not continuous time. It's discrete time, what you see here. So there are, I mean, these are jumps, right? From here to here to here to here. All right, let me go on because if you want, we discuss this afterwards. To give you some intuition for the mechanisms that prevail here. What I want to say is that the mechanism for synchronization and for desynchronization, so for attraction and for instabilities, are in different parts of phase space. And in particular, if you have sub-threshold input, this desynchronizes, as you can see here, if you have two neurons, as same type of figure as before, which receive a spike from some third neuron, then their phase difference increases. If they are far apart from the threshold, so if there is sub-threshold input. On the other hand, if these two phases are close to threshold, and so they receive a spike, which then is supra-threshold, then these two neurons will fire immediately when they receive the spike from the third one, since they reach the threshold immediately and they are set to zero simultaneously. So that's a mechanism for synchronization. And it just depends on where you are in phase space, here at these phases or at these phases. And so in different parts of phase space, you have different mechanisms at work. And here's a intuitive sketch how to imagine this in it's a six-dimensional phase space. You have a basin of attraction, and there are these four eigenvalues that are equal to zero. So in a finite time, from this basin of attraction, you are contracted to a two-dimensional manifold. Finite because of these synchronizations that I just showed you, the sub-threshold synchronization mechanism gives you a synchronization in finite time, reducing the system to a lower dimension manifold. So in a finite time, you get into such an attractor, which has an unstable direction attached to it. So this is how to imagine the these unstable attractors.
So you are doing analysis, you can see any matches or other numbers. Why will the attracting direction be charged
as negative eigenvalues? There are no negative eigenvalues.
But it seems like in your picture, if you do a linear analysis of that fixed point, there are
if you want, they are super attracting. The lambdas are equal to zero. The eigenvalues are equal to zero. So the contraction, let me call it contraction, happens in finite time. So it's like in a one-dimensional map when you have a superstable fixed point. You can reach the attractor in a finite time and not asymptotically in exponentially asymptotically.
That's because the spikes make a finite step in the
Yeah. No. Okay, let me go to come to the end of this part and give you some more results. Guess you would not like to sit here too long. So for large systems, the mechanisms that are at work can be read in this article by Mark Timmer, Fred Wolf, and myself. And okay, this was for intuition here. And now some more numerical results for large networks. Since what you saw here was just the n equals 6 network that can be treated mostly analytically. Now for large networks, as a function of the size of the network, we determined the fraction of unstable attractors, and also depending on the parameters, tau and epsilon. And so it turns out that there are parameters where you have almost only unstable attractors, but they also have parameters where you have almost only stable attractors. Let me start here. So for 2, 3, 4 units, there are no unstable attractors. Then you find a finite number of unstable attractors, and this number approaches 1 as n increases up to 100 or so. So unstable attractors appear to become typical for larger networks. And as I said, this depends on the parameters. For a particular parameter, this goes to 1, and the number of stable attractors goes to 0, and in for other delays, the number of unstable attractors goes to 0, but for other parameters, and the number of stable attractors goes to 1. We've just looked here at the period 1 attractors. Okay, and here is what you see as a function of parameters. This parameter space is, this phase diagram is colored in black. If there is a majority of unstable attractors, the fraction is larger than 1/2, and it's colored in white if the fraction is smaller than 1/2. And so you see that as a function of parameters and as a function of, depending on the parameters, unstable attractors become typical for large networks. Okay. Maybe one remark on the possible function of such unstable attractors. They give the system an increased flexibility due to this switching from one attractor to the other. And this could be useful in certain tasks. Okay, so in the last part of our talk, I'd just like to present work on irregular network structures where the units are no longer coupled globally, nor are they coupled locally, but there is some randomness in the connections for some general irregular coupling, and we assume asymmetric networks where these arrows do not necessarily go in both directions. And the question is, does the topology and this randomness of the network influence the dynamics of synchronization? And here are some results. This is the numerical results for dilute asymmetric random networks, here with a number of units, 1,024 units, and a connectivity k equals 32, so we have more than 1,000 units, and each unit receives input from 32 others, and we assume inhibitory coupling. Time delays, of course, but here in this part of the talk, we only assume inhibitory coupling, and the coupling is normalized by the number k, the connectivity. So, what you see here is the distance from an attractor. Again, of course, we expect that the inhibitory coupling leads to stable attraction, and as a function of time, the distance from the attractor decreases exponentially, as you can see. Now, from this slope, we determine the synchronization. We can determine the speed of synchronization, or the synchronization time, which is the time in the exponential or 1/1 tau. And this synchronization time decreases as a function of the coupling strength, as you can see. So as the coupling strength increases, the question was asked before, how does the synchronization depend on the coupling strength? I think you asked this. The synchronization becomes faster, so the synchronization time decreases, but as epsilon becomes larger, goes to infinity probably, there is a lower bound for the synchronization time, an upper bound for the synchronization speed that is not crossed. So for infinite coupling strengths, we still have a finite synchronization speed. That's a numerical result, and we can understand this. So one can apply random matrix theory to this, and it's a case where our activities in quantum chaos, one example of various of many examples actually where the expertise in our group for quantum chaos, especially random matrix theory, has been fruitful in neuroscience context, and vice versa. And so here's, for instance, first of all, the Gershgorin theorem. It tells you that the eigenvalues of an n by n matrix are confined to circles. And in this case, in this model, when we look at the eigenvalues of the stability matrix of this system, it's 1/4 to 12. So in this case, the stability matrix is such that all these Gershgorin circles are the same. So they have the they form the same center and have actually the same radius. Now there is one eigenvalue which is equal to 1. It's a trivial eigenvalue. It just corresponds to the time translation, so the invariance with respect to time translation. And therefore, you always have an eigenvalue equal 1. And for our stability matrix, we can calculate the Gershgorin circles, just one Gershgorin circle. It is located at A0, which is the diagonal element of the stability matrix, which can be calculated easily. And its radius comes out as 1 minus A0. So this is why it touches 1 here. So it's A0 and radius 1 minus A0. So the Gershgorin circle touches this 1 here. But you see that the iron girders are contained within. So this already gives us an indication that there cannot be instability. It must be at least neutrally stable. So if the eigenvalues reach, if there was an eigenvalue on the circle, then here on this point, then you would have neutral stability. Actually, we'll show that it is rigorously stable. Because the eigenvalues are all within. Okay, so this is a result from the Gershgorn theorem. And here are numerical results. What you see here in more detail is again this trivial eigenvalue, the unit circle, and here the distribution of eigenvalues. And what I showed you before was the Gershgorn circle, which touches here. But as you see, the eigenvalues apparently remain confined to a different circle of smaller radius. Can we understand this? Well, we can understand it by analogy to something else in random matrix theory. When you consider asymmetric Gaussian random matrices, then they have eigenvalues that are distributed uniformly in disks in the complex plane. And, okay. These, I guess I have to jump one more forward here. Okay. And here are again some numerical results for increasing numbers of n. And what you see apparently is that the eigenvalues are confined to a circle with uniform distribution inside as n goes to infinity. And now those are sparse asymmetric random matrices, the stability matrices, whose eigenvalue you can see here. And there is this theory of Gaussian random matrices, which gives us a measure for the radius. Tells us how the eigenvalues are distributed in this circle, and determines us the radius. So what happens here, apparently, is that we get the same radius, and the eigenvalues are also distributed in such a radius, whose width is determined by, if we replace the variance of these matrix elements, by the variance of the matrix elements of our sparse matrix. So this seems to be realized here numerically. And if we assume that there is this analogy, so that we can describe the radius of this eigenvalue circle by using the Gaussian random matrix theory, then we can derive a result for the radius of the circle for the sparse stability matrices. And what we did also was to shift the center of these, to transform the matrices such that the center is shifted to zero, so we can apply this Gaussian random matrix theory. Okay, and the result is given here. The radius then goes like the square root of 1 over k minus 1 over n. And that's shown here. Okay. Numerically, for increasing, for networks with of increasing size n, this radius increases like 1 over square root. And on the other hand, for a network of size 1024, I think, as a function of the connectivity k, the radius decreases. And again, from if you have the radius, we also have, we can look at the largest possible eigenvalue, which gives us the speed limit. We can calculate it, this exponent tau for the speed of synchronization. Analytically, from this result, and it comes out as 2 over ln k. And I have another figure for this. But before I show this, let me mention two things. First of all, we do have an eigenvalue gap from here to here. So that means stable, the synchrony is stable. And it's also robust against perturbations, against structural variations, since there is a finite distance between these eigenvalues. And also, importantly, the speed limit is independent of n, of the network size. So the radius increases, But as n goes to infinity, this does not, it still increases monotonically, but it converges. So the tau, the synchronization time is bounded. So the, as note also that as n increases, the network becomes more and more dilute. Relatively less connections between among the network, and but nevertheless, there's still a finite speed limit. So this is independent of n, and the speed doesn't go down to zero, although the network becomes infinite. Okay, and here's again. This result compared the analytical result, which is based on this hypothesis of assuming that the distribution of eigenvalues of sparse random matrices can be described by the distribution of eigenvalues of Gaussian random matrices. So this analytic result compared with the numerical result, and as you can see, this seems to fit quite well. Now, the conclusion. As the coupling strength increases, you have a finite speed limit, a finite synchronization time that it cannot become smaller. And nevertheless, as n increases, the synchronization does not become slower. And okay, so that's the end of my talk. And yeah, thank you.